The morning of the Lord's Day, July 23rd, 1637, was a typical summer day in the city of Edinburgh, Scotland. It had been only 15 years since the death of Andrew Melville, of whom we spoke last Lord's Day evening, Melville being the successor of John Knox, and Melville survived his mentor by 50 years. That morning, in the Cathedral of St. Giles, which to this very day is one of the most distinctive landmarks in the city of Edinburgh, especially the old city, in that cathedral where Knox and Melville had often preached, the hour of 8 o'clock arrived with an apprehensive congregation waiting for the beginning of the service of worship. Why were they apprehensive? Well, they had heard that under the orders of Charles Laud, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and King Charles I, the typical Presbyterian service that had been going on for decades was to be replaced by a new service, much more in keeping with the desires of the Romanist sympathizers, like the wife of the king, who had great influence at the king's court. Just after the appointed hour, a man appeared at the reading desk of the cathedral and said with tears in his eyes, "Adieu, good people, for this is the last time I shall ever read prayers in this church." Moments afterward, the dean of the cathedral appeared, dressed not in the typical Presbyterian manner, but in the vestments more appropriate to the Roman Catholic Mass. And as he mounted the steps to the reading desk, the murmurs in the congregation erupted into shouts of anger and rage. The dean stopped for a moment. He had only read a few words of what was to be more like a Roman Mass than anything else. And suddenly, something whizzed past his ear and cracked into the masonry behind him. A woman called Jenny Geddes, who was a businesswoman in Edinburgh, she had a shop, a stall, in the street just outside the cathedral. And since she found nothing more suitable that was within her reach, she took her stool on which she was sitting and fired it at the dean, just missing it. Her aim was not quite good enough. And at the same time that she fired the stool at him, she shouted, "Villain, dost thou say Mass at my lug?" And the word "lug" was the Scottish word for ear. Now that, as you can imagine, ensured that there would be no sober service that morning. The place dissolved into uproar. And in the uproar, the dean of the cathedral closed his liturgy book, threw off the various vestments, scrambled down the steps from the reading desk, and ran out of the building. Now, the newly appointed Bishop of Edinburgh was also in attendance, and he got up and sought to calm the crowd down. But when the people saw him, they became more furious than before. And so from the crowd came the cries, "A pope! A pope! Antichrist! Pull him down!" And he too had to flee. with all speed in order to keep himself from being physically attacked. It wasn't a very auspicious beginning for the king's campaign that was designed after nearly 80 years of Presbyterianism in Scotland to remove it from the land. You see, the king, Charles I, had received instruction from his father, James I, about the evils of Presbyterianism. He didn't realize that you were in a church that, according to James I, was marked by evil. James told the young prince that it was a form of church government totally incompatible with the monarchy, and therefore should be rooted up. You see, the emphasis of Presbyterianism on the equality of the members and of their elders and their ministers was anathema to the Stuarts, who believed in the divine right of kings. But if King Charles believed that this new policy was going to quickly drown the memories of the Reformation, he was mistaken. He underestimated the character of the Scottish Presbyterians. There was a document called the National Covenant. It had been signed on two previous occasions in those 80 years. And it was brought out again and revised for the needs of the hour. And on March 1st, 1638, a solemn assembly of nobles, barons, gentlemen, burgesses, ministers, and commoners assembled in the Greyfriars Church in Edinburgh. Now that's just a short distance, just really around the corner from St. Giles Cathedral. And there they signed the National Covenant, and promised in the language of the document, all the days of our life, constantly to adhere unto and to defend the true religion. They also vowed, in the language of the covenant, to labor by all means lawful to recover the purity and liberty of the gospel as it was established and professed, and that we shall defend the same and resist all these contrary errors and corruptions according to our vocation and to the utmost of that power which God hath put into our hands all the days of our life. That was 1638. The signing of that document began a struggle that would take 50 years to complete. That is, many of those, in fact, probably all of those who were there on that day, who put their signatures to that document, were not around to see the end of the struggle. It was a struggle to preserve what their Presbyterian forefathers had secured at a very high cost. It would hardly be considered an irony that many of the Covenanters over the years that followed would be held as prisoners in the very same churchyard where the National Covenant had been signed. There they would be confined in cells without roofs, exposed to the bitterness of Scottish winters, and often would die in the snow and ice that came to encrust their bodies. Charles wanted his way, but the Presbyterians of Scotland knew what the stakes were. Their liberties to worship God according to the Scriptures were on the line, and they would not surrender the blessing of truly Protestant worship and truly Protestant church government. They wouldn't let them go. They vowed to maintain the independence of the church from the monarch. And that purpose would lead many of the covenanters to their deaths, and others to spend their time hiding in caves and in dens of the earth. Without access to their church buildings, they were compelled many times to worship outdoors, in remote locations, locations that would not easily be detected by the agents of the king. They would have many through the years who would emulate their noble example. In the days of communism and the Soviet Union, some think those days are not gone, but in the days of the Soviet Union, there would be people who, in order to worship God freely, would have to meet in various remote locations, outdoors. Most of the names of the covenanters who did such things we don't know. They were people who were just trying to make their livings in the world. But they were people who believed in the truth of the gospel. With all their hearts, they believed in it. They knew that there had been committed to them a very important responsibility. And while they recognized that not many after them would even know their names, they knew they were on the front lines in Scotland's Reformation Phase 2. And that's the theme that we set before us this evening. These were difficult times. Through all the trials of those years, the covenanters were often brought very low. They never held a worship service where they did not wonder if the king's soldiers were at that moment marching to that location, having been tipped off by someone who despised the Presbyterians, and they did not know if that worship service would be their last. For there were conventicles that were disrupted by the king's soldiers, and people were put to death by the sword right there on the spot. So when they went to worship God, they did so knowing that there was a definite risk attached to what they were doing. Their persecutors were very strong, and they were extremely cruel. There were no allies who came riding to the rescue of the Covenanters. Even the English Puritans under Oliver Cromwell considered the Scottish Presbyterians to be threats to the government. The Covenanters had no courts to which to turn. They couldn't say, well, we're going to sue those people. There were no lawyers that would represent their cause. They were rebelling against the king. So what was their sole refuge? Like the people in Smyrna, of whom we read in Revelation 2, their sole refuge was the Lord Himself. They were in times of great testing, times of tribulation. But the covenanters teach us afresh not to rely on the arm of flesh. To this very day, the people of God have no one on whom to rely except the Lord Himself. Now, we're going to look at this period in Scotland, and we're going to find it divided into three distinct phases. They won't correspond to the particular points I want to make, but let me just tell you what those phases were so that you get a sense of the history. The first phase began, obviously, in 1638 with the signing of the National Covenant. It went to 1649. In 1649, King Charles I was put to death by the triumphant Puritans in London. The second phase followed that event, and it was a truce of sorts that really paralleled the years when Oliver Cromwell was governing the country in London. So from 1649, the first few years, the Parliament tried to govern. They weren't able to do it. Cromwell seized the role of being really, for practical purposes, a dictator. And that continued until his death in 1658. The third phase of this period began when King Charles II, the son of the executed king, was restored to the throne in 1660. And that was the signal, as we will see, for the renewal of persecution of the Covenanters. And that continued until 1688, the Glorious Revolution, as it's called, or the Bloodless Revolution, as it's sometimes called, that secured, finally, the throne of the United Kingdom for Protestantism. So here, through these three phases, we find various aspects of this second phase of Scotland's Reformation, which was really the battle to save it, the battle to preserve it, the battle to keep all the gains that had been made from being overturned. So first let us notice enmity against the Reformation. Now when we consider the covenanting period, one of the difficulties that we have is we cannot appreciate the level of animosity that had been stirred up by those who were sympathetic to Romanism. We don't appreciate how deeply these people hated what had happened in Scotland at the time of the Reformation. And while John Knox and Andrew Melville had great success in establishing the Reformation, not only religiously, but politically, so that the Parliament of Scotland was responsive to the needs of the Reformation, even though that was true, and even though all these years had passed, the Romanists, and particularly those in places of power, harbored the hope that the work of the Reformation could be overthrown. That the laws that had established it in Scotland could be repealed. And the nation could be returned, yes, by force if necessary, to its Romanist heritage. Now, they didn't understand what had happened. When liberty is let out, you can't come along and say, well, let's bottle it back up again and put it back in the box and shove it back into the closet. You can't do that. There was, in this enmity, a contempt for the way in which the Protestants worshiped. Yes, the way in which we would worship, they had contempt for it. They ridiculed, for example, the simple Geneva gowns that the Presbyterian ministers would wear in their pulpits. They ridicule the simplicity of the order of service, that there was nothing elaborate, no spectacle for the people to admire. But that was not the heart of the enmity. The heart of the enmity was the message that the Protestants preached, and that was justification by faith alone, in the merits of Christ alone. The centrality of Christ in Protestant preaching was that which distressed those who were faithful to Rome and made them want to overturn the Reformation. Now, let me give you an illustration of this enmity, for it did appear in a very definite way. I was speaking a little while ago about the antipathy that King James I had toward the Presbyterians. He hated them. It was the result of that enmity that reforms were enacted by the Parliament in connection with the manner of worship. That is, worship was restricted to one service on Sunday. Any other preaching outside that service was forbidden by law. Now, I suppose that there are a lot of churches today who would not be distressed at all if such a law were passed. It wouldn't affect their operations one bit. But they had a problem then, because then there had to be something to fill up the rest of the day. What were the people going to do? There wasn't any internet. There was no television. So what were the people going to do? Well, James, the king, urged the people to take part in sports and recreation, as long as they went to church in the morning. You went to church in the morning, then you could spend the rest of the day attending fairs, playing games, and so on. In fact, it was John Bunyan who said that the first time he had ever been convicted about his sin was while he was involved in recreation on a Sunday afternoon, after he had been to the one service that was permitted. He was engaging in the activity that the King of England himself, in the early part of the 17th century, had encouraged. Now, that may sound a little familiar to you, and so it is. The idea that as long as you do your bit for God by turning up at church on Sunday morning, the rest of the day is yours to do what you please with. The emphasis of the Reformation on personal piety and attention to the doctrines of the Scriptures drew some of the sharpest rebukes from the enemies of the Reformation. They said, basically, these Presbyterians are far too serious about their religion. They need to lighten up. They need to enjoy life a little bit more. But there was one thing about the Presbyterians in Scotland, and that is they were not to be intimidated. So that brings me to say, secondly, resolve for the Reformation. And that resolve was reflected in this national covenant that had been signed. It showed the character of the Scottish people. Now, the character that was on display in those days has been almost completely eliminated from Scotland over the years since that time. If you go to Scotland nowadays, you will find almost complete atheism. There is very little left in the way of the legacy of Knox and Melville and the Covenanters. But it was just 5 years after the signing of the National Covenant that a document very much like it was signed in London. That was the year 1643. And that was the very year in which the Westminster Assembly began its work. And in that year, people from Scotland and England and Wales came to London, and there they signed what came to be known as the Solemn League and Covenant. And after the signing, Alexander Henderson, who had been present 5 years before in Greyfriars Churchyard at the signing of the National Covenant there, preached a sermon that ended with these words: "Did the Pope at Rome know what is this day transacting in England, and were this covenant written on the plaster of the wall over against him, where he sitteth Belshazzar-like in his sacrilegious pomp, it would make his heart to tremble, his countenance to change, his head and mitre to shake, his joints to loose, and all his cardinals and prelates to be astonished." By the time that this Solemn League and Covenant was signed and the Westminster Assembly had convened, King Charles had encountered a number of reversals and was involved in a civil war with forces loyal to the Puritans. But the fact that he was involved in war did not stop him from trying to advance the policy he had sought to begin in Scotland. And so that brings me, thirdly, to speak about war upon the Reformation. Now, the early efforts that Charles had made to suppress the Reformation in Scotland didn't have much success. They weren't pursued, perhaps, with the intensity that was needed, and the people tended to ignore them. The king was distracted. In fact, as time went by, he became more and more distracted because his forces were suffering defeats at the hands of those under the command of Oliver Cromwell. Still, he was furious against the Presbyterians, and he gave Charles Laud, the Bishop of London at that time, a free hand in ordering the arrest and punishment of various people, including ministers. Anyone who resisted the king's policy was subject to arrest. Some of these people were put into stocks. Now, that was a punishment that was still in use in colonial America. There are places you can go where you can see stocks that they used in that time. Some were put into stocks. Some had their ears cut off in public. Others were flogged in public. The death penalty was not yet available for the crime of being a Presbyterian, and especially the crime of having signed the covenant or being loyal to it. But those who sought to preserve the Reformation paid a heavy price. I want to emphasize that to you this evening. We are here this evening because people whose names we don't even know, when confronted with the authority of the king, said, "We will remain true to the gospel of the Lord Jesus." They are like those of whom we read in Revelation 2 and verse 10. "The devil shall cast some of you into prison, that ye may be tried, and ye shall have tribulation 10 days. There will be a period of intense trial." They paid a heavy price The Lord said to the people in Smyrna, "Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee the crown of life." It looked very bleak at this point. But then the forces of history brought to the Covenanters a reprieve. And the fourth aspect of this struggle was a time of truce for the Reformation. Because the forces under Oliver Cromwell in England won the English Civil War, they forced the surrender of the army of Charles, and they took him into custody. And eventually, because Charles was found to have been engaging in treasonous efforts to form an alliance with Roman Catholic powers in Europe, because of that, he was charged with being a traitor, was put on trial by the commons, and was sentenced to death by beheading. And that sentence was carried out in 1649 in London. Now, with his death, of course, the policies that he had espoused were not espoused then so keenly as they had been. And the immediate threat to the Presbyterians in Scotland had passed. But there was still friction during those years with the government that Cromwell set up beginning in 1653, because Cromwell did not really care for the Presbyterians in Scotland. When Cromwell died in 1658, his son Richard, really the one who had survived the warfare in the 1640s, he took over the running of the country, but he did not have his father's skill or his father's resources. And so the people began agitating to have a king again. And that desire led to what was in many ways the most bitter part of this whole struggle. The fifth thing, faithfulness in the Reformation. 1660 was a critical year. That was the year when Charles II, the son of the executed king, was brought to London and crowned as king. And as soon as he had become king, he began to move against the Covenanters and against other nonconformists in England. The Covenanter ministers were removed from their pulpits, usually by force. Leaders of the movement, even those who were nobles, were arrested and put to death. Now, if you want to read something of the character of this time in Scottish history and of the people of that period, you would do well to read Scott's Worthies or a little book by Jock Purvis called Fair Sunshine. You'll read stories there about some thrilling things that happen in terms of the faithfulness of the people of God. You'll read about some of the ministers who were active in that period. Now, those people didn't know if anyone would ever tell their stories. They didn't know if anyone would ever take any note at all of what they had done. But they had resolved that they would never surrender. Years went by. Talking about a period now of 28 years. These were some of the darkest days in Scottish history. More and more ministers were arrested and put to death. What was the crime with which they were charged, for which they were condemned to death? it was that they would not repudiate the national covenant. Now, by this time, you're quite a ways past the time when that covenant was signed. Many of these men would not have been present at that time. But they would not abandon the principles of the covenant. What they refused to do was to allow to the king any rights to control the church of Jesus Christ. It was from this period that there arose that expression that they would contend for Christ's crown and covenant. That they would contend for the crown rights of King Jesus. When they came to die, many of the preachers of that period, at the very place of execution, preached lengthy sermons. That is, they were given the opportunity to speak any final words, and some of them probably made those who gave them the opportunity regret doing so because some of them spoke for more than an hour. They would be speaking from the top of a ladder. They would climb up a ladder. And at the top of the ladder was a crossbar, a gallows, and a rope would be placed around their necks, and they would be allowed to say whatever they wanted to say. And then when they had finished, they would be turned over that crossbar, and they would be hanged. And it went on. Year after year. Out in the countryside, the conventicles went on too, and it seemed that whenever a minister was put to death, that someone else was raised up to take his place. And they couldn't stamp them out. They just couldn't stamp them out. And so the executions went on. Then came the year 1688. And in that year, the people of England had had enough of Charles II and of his son, James II, and they sent word to Holland, to the Netherlands, to the House of Orange. And this is how Orange came to be associated with Protestantism. They sent word to the House of Orange that they wanted William of Orange and Mary, his wife, to come to take up the throne of England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. And so there was a revolution. The Parliament passed the enabling legislation, and that legislation said that from that time forth, from 1688 on, no Roman Catholic of either gender could ever occupy that throne. Now, those laws are still in force today, although it hasn't been for lack of trying to get rid of them. What it meant was that Protestantism had been vindicated as the religion of the realm. But those who opposed the covenanters would still not relent. And for 2 years after 1688, the struggle continued. The army that was loyal to James II, well, I say army, I don't think it was anything that would be called an army nowadays, some scattered units that had stayed with James II, they took shipping and went to Ireland. And they began attacking the king's forces in Ireland. And finally, William of Orange was compelled to go across to Ireland himself and to lead the fight against James II. And in 1690, at the Battle of the Boyne, in July of 1690, William of Orange finally defeated James and his forces, and that settled the future of Scotland. That meant that the Covenanters would not be persecuted anymore. So finally, after 130 years, we say that this is the 450th anniversary of the Reformation in Scotland. 1560 is when the Reformation became the law of the land in Scotland. 130 years later, finally, the last opposition to it was put down. And the work that Knox and Melville had done, the work that had preceded them through the sacrifice of Patrick Hamilton and George Wishart, that work was established. The importance of that was that during this period, there were a number of Scottish Presbyterians who took shipping and went to the New World. And there they formed Presbyterian churches in Western Virginia, Western Pennsylvania, Eastern Tennessee, Eastern Kentucky, Western North and South Carolina. The Presbyterian heritage of those areas was the result of Scottish Presbyterians who came into that area. What was the point of it all? Well, if we look back at the words of our text, the Lord Jesus said to the people in Smyrna, "Fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer." It was the word to the covenanters they were going to suffer. The Lord was saying to them, don't be afraid of those things. It's easy to say not to be afraid of something. But as I have said, they were very dark days. Here was the word of the Lord. Fear none of those things. Here was the promise that the covenanters used and that gave them hope. I will give thee a crown of life. They were being faithful to Christ. And for many of them, it meant that they could no longer live in this world. When I think of this struggle to secure the blessings of the Reformation for generations that would follow, and when I think of the way in which the devil continued trying to undermine that work in the 18th and 19th centuries in Scotland, it reminds me that we live in a time when we are called to defend the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. This church has been called into existence to preserve that which the reformers established at such a high cost. We are here in this place to ensure that our children and our young people do not grow up without the knowledge of that which has gone before. This week, the American Council of Christian Churches will meet in convention, and the theme of the convention is faithfulness from generation to generation. When I think of that and I think of the covenanters, I think of the challenge that comes to us. Because as the Scriptures tell us, there was a generation that arose that did not know Joshua, that did not know the works that the Lord had done for His people. And how did that come about? That came about because at some point, there was a break. At some point, that heritage was not transmitted from one generation to the next. And I'm here to tell you, that's all it takes. One breakdown, one failure to transmit that heritage, and everything falls with it. We have been called then to remember what was done in days gone by, but at the same time, the resolve that we will transmit this glorious heritage, Christ and Him crucified, the gospel of a free justification by faith alone, we will transmit it to those who are coming after us in the way. May God give us the grace to be faithful then to the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ.